I just want to let you know that I have a handout for you. I come from Brazil, and in Brazil, I've learned to not to rely on technology, because sometimes it doesn't work, and other days it doesn't work either. So I came prepared with handouts, because instead of having a PowerPoint presentation or having to rely on video clips or things like that. But also because this will allow us to have more of a conversation, I'm hoping. The handout, I'm going to ask for volunteers to read a couple of paragraphs from it, and then we can engage in a conversation after each one of the sections. But also, if the conversation moves us elsewhere and we do not get to the end of what I had foreseen, that's fine, you can just read it on your own. So we are not bound to this piece of paper. It should help us to get some basic notions of what it is that I want to talk, but that's not really the purpose of our time together. It's really to draw on the wealth of experiences that you bring and how you think that your experiences can help us have a better understanding of how to be called, or how you feel that you are called to be global citizens. So the answer to this is not only mine, but it's also and primarily yours. This is my name. You can pronounce it three ways, and I answer by all of them. You can go with the American way, and that would be Wanda. Wanda. You can go with the German way, because that is my part of my 19th century ancestry to Brazil, and you can say Wanda, and that I will respond to, because that's also the way my grandmother used to call me. Or you can try the Portuguese way, which is Wanda. So whichever you feel comfortable, I answer to all of that.
Oh, the French way, Wanda.
Oh, okay.
That sounds very nice.
Okay, so we can start thinking now. The topic that we are addressing today is called to be global citizens. And the notion of citizenship, or the topic of citizenship, has been very much on the front of newspapers, part of headlines, because citizenship is quite often connected with issues such as immigration, or with what the roles of people are in this particular country. And I have been quite intrigued by that, because I am not a US citizen, and I always shy away from giving opinions about political issues, and yet, very similar to Martin Luther in his days, I'm quite opinionated about things. So you can imagine that that is a very difficult exercise. And I had to find a framework in my mind that would allow me to, who am I accountable also for things that are happening not only in my parts of the world, namely Brazil or Latin America, but also how can I be more involved in things that are happening in this country? And the language of accountability came to my mind. And I was looking for where in the religious theological tradition do we find that more strongly voiced. And if you have participated in the Bible studies, and I hope you have this morning, you find it very present in the biblical language. However, I'm not a biblical scholar. I am a systematic theologian. And as a systematician, as a theologian, I like to connect things that do not always seem easy to connect. Then I went back to my roots. I am, after all, a Lutheran pastor, and looked into the Lutheran tradition. Where do we find the foundation? Where lies the motivation for Christians to actually be involved in issues that go beyond their immediate realm of concern? And I found that, first of all, in Martin Luther's Two Kingdom Theory. Now, if I could ask somebody to read the two first paragraphs of this handout, it gives you a very quick summary of what that theory is all about. Can somebody volunteer to read? Thank you.
Martin Luther said that the spiritual and earthly governments constitute two realms. One is guided by the law and the other by the gospel, but both belong to God. God rules over both kingdoms, heaven and earth, and instituted two kinds of government. One is spiritual, through which humans become devout and righteous. This authority acts through the word and without the sword, and righteousness is given through the gospel. The other is earthly government, through which humans are compelled to be righteous before the world. This transitory righteousness is accomplished through the sword, which makes sure that believers and unbelievers alike comply with the law, living in justice and peace. Good governance is instituted by God as part of God's care for the entire creation. Of course, if the world were composed of real Christians, there would be no need for government or for the law, because the righteous does more than all that the law demands. Since, however, such true Christians are hard to find, all citizens are subject to the word because they because they need the law to instruct, constrain, and compel them to do what is good. In the earthly realm, the law is not only good and necessary, but it is also God-given.
This was so well read by a Methodist. I know we just shared that you are a Methodist background. Does this resonate with some of the teachings that you have heard, or those of you who are Lutherans? Is this, are you familiar with this notion of Martin Luther's two realms or two kingdoms? Can anybody explain this a little bit better than this? You were laughing?
I thought it was pretty well explained.
So, one of the temptations, this is a basic teaching within the Lutheran tradition and Protestant tradition in general, because other reformers have also embraced this and tried to live accordingly. One of the temptations coming from this two realm or two kingdom theory is that Christians do not need to be engaged in anything related to this world, because after all, we are Christians, and so we are guided first and foremost by the spiritual realm, that we are guided by the gospel, that we are justified by faith, and that pretty much would exempt us of doing anything in the here and now. And nothing could be further away from what Martin Luther was actually developed in this. And so I want to go back to the core of that teaching show to you why it is that the two-realm theory, the two-kingdom theory, is actually the key motivation why Christians not only have an opportunity, but also an obligation and an invitation to be active participants in what goes on in the world. And that has to do with the fact that even though we are Christians, we are still subject to the law. The law does not have anything to do with our salvation, because we know that we cannot be justified by fulfilling the law. And yet, we are under the law because the law means to say, to do good, to act justly, to do what is right, is also a constant reminder of our own constant shortcomings, that we are sinful and we cannot always fulfill that, but also motivation to lead us in the path of just living. Luther himself did not write extensively about sanctification, although this is very much a part of how we live a life that is the life of somebody who is justified and yet continues to be a sinful and a saint person at the same time, and in always and constantly striving to reach that sanctified level. However, we do not quite get to do it in the totality right now. We always live in reality of already and not yet. Therefore, we all are 100% sinful, but we all 100% saints. So we live with that dichotomy, within that creative tension within ourselves. Can I ask somebody to read the next two paragraphs? Would you? Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you.
Christians, therefore, are citizens of the earthly realm. Currently, our notion of citizenship focuses most often on how individuals get to exercise their rights. Because a citizen is a native-born or naturalized person who owes allegiance to a particular country and is entitled to its protection, we We concentrate on the privilege that citizenship confers. Rights are a vital part of citizenship, and social movements have mobilized around them. However, the language of rights does not always fully translate the meaning of citizenship. Citizenship also entails responsibilities and obligations. It describes the relationship between the state and individual citizens, as well as the political relationship between the citizens themselves. Besides rights and the entitlement to the state's protection, citizenship also refers to the duties, actions, and virtues expected from each citizen. For Aristotle, citizenship was primarily a duty. Citizens were obliged to take turn in public office and sacrifice part of their private life to do so. Okay. The idea of citizenship as a duty contrasts sharply with our contemporary mindset. In the United States, liberalism deeply influences the understanding of citizenship. Freedom, self-determination, and self-creation are highly valued, and these values are important components of citizens' self-perception. Liberalism stresses not only the right to participate in public life, whether by voting or holding public office, but also the privilege not to do so. It defends the right to place private commitment ahead of political involvement. We are becoming aware of the increasing number of people who see it as their right not to be politically involved.
So this is a reality that I'm facing, especially in the context of young college-educated people in this country. Those of you who have been participants in any social political movement, whether it be civil rights, whether it be feminist movement, whether it be for the rights sanctuary movement, the rights of refugees, you know how that type of involvement has shaped who you are. And if I were to ask you to define what citizenship is, you would probably go beyond the language of rights and responsibilities. But first of all, talking about rights, that we have entered the 20th century very much aware that rights are not available to everybody. And this goes back, let me just exemplify that to you with women's rights to vote. Mm-hmm. I know some of you were involved in the women's movement, and you know how important it was for important figures like Mary Wollstonecraft and Olympe de Gouges to advocate for the rights of women. And the right of women meant that we want to be equal. Equal in that sense that not only having access to the same privileges that men would have in society, but that equality would see that women would have be treated as with the same level of respect and dignity as anybody else would be in society. Those of you who were aware of the civil rights movement in this country, you know what impact it had for African Americans, first to have right to have education, the right for full participation, the end of the Jim Crow laws in the South. All of that really shaped who you are as a nation and how you yourselves inspired other people around the globe to strive for the same level of participation in society, because discrepancies, because social injustices, because hierarchies in society that are explained away, you know, by saying, well, this is just God's will, or this is just the way nature intends it to be, and discrimination on the basis of gender or race or religion or age, all of that exists around the world. And so many countries around the world have, in fact, looked at what is the history of the United States and said, well, here we have a model. France, needless to say, is another model, because the French Revolution, with the slogan of Liberté, Fraternité, Égalité, really also shaped the notion of participation and democracy elsewhere. Now, if we are to focus, however, only on rights and responsibilities, it has, we are brought into a very, I would say, nuanced and sometimes very dangerous understanding what citizenship is. I was a visiting professor at the University of Toronto in Canada some years ago. And as I was talking about the church's involvement in social justice issues and referring in a class to just the evening events, you know, what had, you know, been discussed in the evening news, and very much, you know, according to Karl Barth, saying that a good theologian needed to have the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other hand. One student told me that she never watched the news, that there was just too much violence and things that offended her so much that she did not want to hear the news, and that she saw that as a matter of survival. And I have worked with you know, people in Brazil who were like street children or landless peasants, and I've never seen the notion that it is a matter of survival, that somebody would use that sentence and say, now my survival really depends on just being immune or just shutting out other people's plight. I do not want to be aware of what is going on in the world. It is now my right not to participate. And I think there is a generation coming on, I mean, and you will say, well, there's a lot, you know, as of recent, with the whole involvement in political campaigning, that really had that impetus of political participation and getting a massive mobilization in this country. But just so that you're aware that this rhetoric of it is my right not to be involved, that that is something very catchy. And I don't know if you have noticed that as well. If I were to ask you, what do you understand citizenship to be? What would be your definition? What is citizenship for you? You do not have to draw on Martin Luther's, you know, say, well, here is what a citizen is supposed to be doing in the world. But if I just, you know, spring out the word citizenship, what does it mean to you?
It means that it's an active participation in the government and rules and regulations that govern my society, both my responsibility to do that and also my action to do that.
Beautiful. That's very well said. How would you people respond to this particular student in my class? My jaw just dropped and I didn't know what to say.
Well, I think it depends on having a reliable source of news.
Mm-hmm.
I've been really turned off by TV news lately because it seems trivial and it seems repetitive. I mean, you keep hearing the same thing over and over. So there's something to having, to trying to find a reliable source of good news.
I think you just named, you named a very important issue that people in this country have an overabundance of information. You are flooded by information. And it's almost like having to build an ark to be able to, you know, how do you sift through all of that? I grew up in a military dictatorship in Brazil, and we had no information. So the preconceived idea or the preconception that I have is that to strive to get information is something very important because information is not always given to us. So I have that suspicion. I mean, it's part of the whole growing up in a dictatorship. You carry some of these things. So we are not always getting all of the news. There is something that is hidden from us. There is some important fact that is not being conveyed. And now you correct me if I'm wrong. In this country, there seems to be this notion that everything is so readily available that the news is there for you to get it, that you can, you don't even have to look for it, it will come to you. And so you don't have to seek for something because you'll be bombarded, you know, as I said, inundated by all of this. And that makes people very lax with even what source of news they will have. It takes a lot of consciousness. It takes a lot of critical discernment to be able to now say, what I hear at the news is really too superficial for me. Or this is just repeating. It's like the sound bites. You know? And that is not what news is all about. And I don't think that Karl Barth was talking about newspaper in the same way as some news read the thing, same 30 seconds and never going depth and experiencing that wanting to get a fuller picture. So
it's reliable and true.
Right.
I mean, the press has a huge responsibility. Mm-hmm. Huge responsibility.
But another thing I find too with the disappearance of printed page newspapers and the appearance of but I can't scan that in the same way. And if I and also in TV news, it's serial. You know, I have to wait and see that one I want to listen to. I can't just scan it, pick out the one I want to go in depth and ignore some of the others. So it's a very different requirement of me as to how I get the news and what I select or what I listen to.
Good. That added to the fact also the immediacy of things. One of the effects of globalization is that we have instant access to things that are happening in other parts of the globe. And of course, some of my friends are very critical of globalization as it is, but I think that we can do a globalization from below and use these types of networks to also create a better awareness of what is going on in parts of the world that are not always as highlighted. Yes?
The whole Middle Eastern situation in the last several months, the explosion of facts or non-facts, but information that's been given to us and for us to sift through has been a eye-opening for us and certainly for the people there as well.
I think your question as to asking what the response would be to that student, not knowing the age but because of the immediacy and the instant gratification that generation, which I'm assuming is a younger generation, is participating in, I think sometimes that response is a cry or a statement of helplessness and lack of foundation and the inability to find anchor to respond to the catastrophes of today's life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that young, but I look at the youth that I deal with, and they haven't dealt with the civil rights and the women's rights and all that. And so the capacity for them to react is diminished because they don't have the tools to do that by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Excellent.
I think this is very interesting because it relates to a conversation I had just before I left Washington with one of the members of our congregation, who was protesting that the sermons were too specifically upsetting. He came to church not to be upset, but to be comforted. And I really didn't have an answer. I couldn't believe I was hearing it. It's real denial of citizenship.
Well, because what is the purpose of the gospel? The gospel is not just a salve or an ointment that you use to spread on yourself, like your basic everyday, Vaseline care lotion or something. But the gospel is there to comfort those who are discomforted, but also to discomfort those who are comfortable. And that is that's the power of the gospel. And the need of the Word of God to adapt to everybody's reality And in my life, I might need to hear a little bit more of gospel or a little bit more of law, depending on the day or the situation or whatever I find myself in. And of course, it's a tricky position for pastors to be in, although I don't think that pastors are the only ones in charge of doing that. Yes?
I don't know whether it's because he's a Lutheran pastor, but I actually represent Episcopalian Cathedral in Seattle, where one of our pastors, one of our clergy is Lutheran, David Masonry. And David never ends a sermon without a challenge. I mean, he gives us something to take out and say, okay, what are you going to do about this? And it's much more than I've seen in the Episcopalian tradition.
I see, going back to the question about citizenship, I see it as a commitment and participation for the general good.
Okay. I'll come back. While we continue reading a couple more paragraphs, I want you to start thinking in your minds, how does this whole conversation relate to your personal lives and to your own experiences? Because I want to allow plenty of time for us to share about what your passion is and how is it that you got so passionate about this, and what level of involvement that you have, and how you think citizenship or a call to global citizenship, to be global citizens, how that is happening in your lives or in your communities. Can you just go to the second page and the first full paragraph in the quotation by Martin Luther? Can I have a volunteer to read that?
The political vocation of a Christian is to pursue neighborly love fashioned by relationships of justice. Christians are devout and righteous before the world not because they want to be rewarded with eternal life. They know that salvation can never be achieved this way. They do, however, fulfill their vocation and carry on with their responsibilities. Christians are not to escape this world nor defer responsibility to others. To the contrary, Christians are called to serve the world, the earthly kingdom, in whichever capacity is needed. That calling, vocation, or beruf, takes shape in different offices ranging from the tasks of educator, public servant, or parent. Our vocation locates us in our social relationships in family, work, church, country, and as global citizens, allowing us to spell out who the neighbor Jesus referred to actually is. As a man can serve God in the state of matrimony, in husbandry, or at trade for the benefit of his fellow man, and must serve him if necessity demand, just so he can also serve God in the state and should serve him there if the necessities of his neighbor demand it. For the state is God's servant and workman to punish the evil and protect the good.
So this comes from Martin Luther. Quite well known, you probably read that already, from the Secular Authority, in which he really spells out what the role of a Christian should be in society. And I think this should be part of the basic, you know, Sunday school curriculum, of, at least in Lutheran congregations. Probably it is. Maybe it is in yours. When we have always identified that Lutheran theology is a theology focused on justification by faith, because we rely so much on grace. We often forget that Luther had a dual view of what justice actually was and how that righteousness actually works. And he used the expression, there is alter righteousness and there is proper righteousness. Alter righteousness because it's a righteousness that we receive from Christ who justifies us. But then there's a righteousness that acts through us, in us, because of that righteousness that we have received from Christ. And that righteousness allows us then to do good works in society. And those good works are what Luther calls, that's our vocation. Our vocation is our calling in life, is to be doing good. That's what the Christian life is all about. And we might think that doing good has to do with some lofty ideas. Say, I will now go leave my family behind and I will do missionary work in, I know, Tierra del Fuego in the southern part of Chile, maybe, that is not necessarily all there is to it. And Luther had a beautiful way of explaining that concept of vocation that encompassed every aspect of human life. My vocation as a mother, my vocation as a teacher, my vocation as a neighbor, my vocation as a friend, my vocation to be a listener, all of that is what makes for citizenship. Now, he expanded that to include then all sorts of ministry, but that's our calling. And our calling is ultimately a calling to be human beings. And that is what God is calling us to be doing, is to be human beings to one another. So vocation as a call to be global or is just a matter of expanding our neighborhood and saying, who is my neighbor? Who is the person that I'm helping? Is it by changing the diapers of my own children? Or is it by making sure there is drinking water in Liberia? Or that I'm concerned with human rights violation in China and I want to be doing something about that? So all of these are aspects of it. And one of the things I like about Luther's notion of vocation is that he does not pity one against the other, say what you are doing is more important or less important, because all of them are put on the same level, because all of them are aspects that assure that life goes on, that there is quality to the way that we live, that there is well-being for everybody. And that calling is a calling that we receive first of all, from our mother's wombs already. You know, he has some beautiful writings in which, you know, he talks about that God has called us into existence already before we were born, and that calling to be God's children, which then applies to everybody else being God's children, which then dramatically changes then the way that we interact with one another. Can we leave another paragraph? Can I have one here?
Which one do you want?
Citizenship refers not only.
Citizenship refers not only to the individual, but also how individuals live in community. It cannot be reduced to the ballot a citizen casts every so often, which still can defer the responsibility of decision making to others, or to be elected for public office, but to which extent one is a participant in the decision-making processes. For instance, to measure the political participation of Lutherans simply by asking how many officials elected to office are Lutherans is an oversimplification of Luther's public theology. Although election to public office is one dimension of citizenship, it is not all. A deeper understanding of political participation must name the strategies and the levels of involvement Lutherans have encountered to further the rights of others, assure the well-being of those who are marginalized, or address the needs of neighbors.
Thank you. So I'm picking a bone here with some sociologists of religion, okay? Because mm-hmm. Sociologists of religion will do statistics, and they will say, okay, how can we measure the level of political participation of denominations? How is it that they will measure the level of political participation of denominations? They will just say, how many people are elected to an office? So they will say, oh, well, there are so many Roman Catholics, there are so many Lutherans, there are so many Methodists, there are so many, and say, well, this is the denomination that is more actively political. And I say, no, this is not how you can, this is, again, not really grasping what the Christian involvement ought to be in the secular realm, in the world of reality, because it misconstrues what political participation is. And so I am, I want to propose a notion of citizenship that goes also beyond to say, well, political representation by holding a political office, or how many Lutherans or how many Anglicans or Episcopalians and how many Methodists have voted in the last elections, which is, again, another misconstrued idea of political participation. Now, you will probably throw me out of here by saying, well, if people in this country do not really have a democracy if they think that political participation is to just elect somebody to office. I mean, that's called representationism. That's not called democracy, right? And that notion that I really want to know what's going on. I want to have that critical discernment. I want to have access to the information. I want to participate. I want to be taken seriously. I want to have my my insights on things. And by having access to knowledge, because knowledge is also power, that then I can participate in the decision-making processes as they are. All of this probably you already know. Some of this you might have thought. But is this something that you heard voiced very often? Or is this something that you yourself will think? Or maybe not. Yeah.
I love Garrison Keillor's analogy to the world as an orchestra, maybe.
Uh-huh.
And he assigns denominations to the various instruments. And, you know, only Garrison Keillor could do this. And I know, I'm remembering, he assigned the violins to the Catholics.
Uh-huh.
And the, you know, big underlying body of Christians. And I'm sorry, I don't remember what the Episcopalians were. But the Lutherans, of course I remember that one. We're the percussionists. We watch the music silently, carefully, and when we have to bang the cymbals, we do it.
Uh-huh.
Right on the beat.
That's an interesting way of describing it. Lake Wobegon and Garrison Keillor are my favorites. What if we were to think about citizenship and political participation, not only in terms of representation or voting, but in participating in organizations or initiatives, non-governmental organizations that promote well-being, that seek justice, or that really try to help the neighbor. So which organizations or which types of initiatives are you people involved in? Or what are some of your concerns and passions?
Immigration reform. Huh? Immigration reform.
Can you just give us a couple more?
To reframe the question, or maybe to put it this way, as Archbishop Desmond Tutu had said, love is more demanding than the law.
Mm-hmm.
And to move into that place to ask the question, who is my neighbor? Mm-hmm. What is my responsibility and how do I respond?
Yeah. I'm always reminded, Bishop Medardo Gomez once, usually very careful with what they say in sermons because, you know, people will remember and go into it. Bishop Medardo Gomez from El Salvador once addressed a group and he said, can you imagine if immigration laws were as strict in Egypt as they are in the U.S. today, when Jesus fled Bethlehem to Egypt, Jesus would not have survived.
No.
And that sticks to you. I mean, to think about that, it's about refugees, but neighbors who need help, and reframing the very question of what makes for immigrants and what their rights are. What else? What's your passion? What's your concern?
Well, my husband is a paraplegic, and so we deal with wheelchairs and all of the things that are involved in disability. And so it's become a big part of my life more than his, because he doesn't have the energy to advocate.
Mm-hmm.
He's just trying to live.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, that's a big advocacy issue. And I think at the beginning it is kind of a law thing, because we live in Canada, but in the United States I don't remember what the initiative was that came through that guaranteed ramps on the sidewalks. Yeah. But what we have discovered in our own lives is accommodation can be made, but it's the welcome into society that we need. And there's a big difference between putting a ramp up to a door and welcoming people in. And so that's become a big part of our citizenship.
I think the whole issue of visibility also. And it is really quite demanding that, in your case, that not only you have to address all of that, but you also have to work to do the work of educating us.
Yeah.
And that is so time consuming and energy demanding. So I'll start with you, because that is, I mean, you're battling so many fronts, and to educate others who are so oblivious about some of the very ways of ostracizing and just making it invisible, thinking that, you know, oh, by not addressing, not touching, not, you know, talking or not looking, that we are doing fine, you know, let's remain invisible here, but that's
just
ostracizing it in the worst way. Yeah.
Wanda, my passion is advocate for justice, and for me, what does that mean is, you know, I came from a very poor country and a very humble family where actually most of the population is illiterate. So for me, justice englobes right to education,
mm-hmm.
right to healthcare system, right to have food on your table, and right to talk about what is going on in the country, and so on. But I have a problem with this. When you advocate for something, you advocate and you actually create possibility for that to happen. But when you do that, in terms of creating dependency, for me, it's not an act of being a citizenship of the world. Because, as you all know, things that are happening in the world now, a lot of organizations are working, a lot of people are traveling, you know, to help. I know some of them are very genuine about it. I would not say they don't know the notion about being a real citizenship of the world, but I realize, I've noticed that most of the organizations that are helping are creating dependency. And
creating what?
Dependency. Yeah, it's, you cannot, it's like, you will not have an education without me, because I am the only one that can bring that up to you. For me, there's the tendency, how could you call that in being, you know, how could you say that you're a citizen of the world as being a Christian?
You just bring forth an issue that I think is a good, has been really highlighted, especially after the earthquake in Haiti, the role of non-governmental organizations. And you know, vast reports being made about what people actually sent to Haiti after the earthquake. Huge amounts of medication that were out of date. Things that were completely irrelevant to Haiti, such as snowsuits and skis. And I mean, all of that took time and energy and tremendous amount of effort to transport there, just because somebody felt good in the way that they were giving something. I'm helping, but what I'm giving is not what people actually want or need. And so I think you're naming something very important. I made a distinction between, in terms of the political rhetoric, in this country, something happens which is illegal in my home country, which is called lobbying. Lobbying is illegal in Brazil. And why? Because you create these groups of interest that will only advocate for themselves. You know, that's why you will have people advocating for guns or for this or that, because they are one, it's like one single platform. It's one issue concern, you know. And you, as you will commence, you know, the political marathon again in this country, you will see how many people actually get involved in politics because they have one issue. Mm-hmm. And which is the whole issue, you know, it's like lobbying for that one, which is different from what I'm asking, a passion. And all of the examples you were giving are examples that you're advocating for, not for yourself, but for somebody else. You're advocating for somebody that is not yourself. And you're advocating not for somebody that is not yourself. And that is, you just named the core examples of what global citizenship is all about, which is to make use of the station in life in which you find yourself, and this is a very, this is Lutheran jargon, you know? The place in life in which you find yourselves and how you use that power, that knowledge, the conditions that you have, the possibilities and chances that you have in your own lives, and how you use that for the betterment of those who are around you. Which really makes us think a little bit broader than saying, well, this is what, that this is my, my one issue. And what you were saying in terms of the lack of accountability that exists in not wanting, not asking the people themselves, how can we be of any use? How can we be of any help? Do you actually want our help? Which is, it's a very difficult question for Americans. One of my professors wrote a book called The Captain American Complex. people don't want Americans here. They want prayer, they want support, but they do not always want that type of intervention. But it's difficult for people in this country to realize that maybe sometimes we need to just listen. Maybe we just need to visit. Maybe we just need to accompany people where they're at. And we are not there to offer the, you know, 10-step plan for redemption that we already have made here.
Another thing is that we don't need to just do the very visible things. So we can, for example, immigrants coming to this country from Latin America, which I've been quite involved in, we make sure that they can go to school, even whether they're legal or not legal. We make sure that they have some access to medical health care. We make sure that we decide whether or not they can have a driver's license and so forth. But even if we do all of those legal, determine all those legal issues, it still doesn't make the person feel a part and a welcome to this country. And the example of this that's really hit me was the young Salvadoran heritage woman who grew up in my house, whose best friend was a blonde, very, very different from her appearance. And we were talking about something shopping with, and Karen said, but Marge, a sales clerk always asked her friend, Christine, can I help you, before they would ask me. Mm-hmm. So it's this sort of subtle thing that makes them, or doesn't make them feel really comfortable as a part of it. So it's they're the political things that are related to law, but then there are the living things that are more subtle.
Something else that you feel passionate about. Yes, please.
Use an old image, law and gospel would be two sides of the coin. I have a real struggle with how much law side American image and attitude makes, which moves us invariably to the sword rather than to the word. And so whether it's just a matter of dominance or dependence, it's because of that sword theology. How would Luther deal with that, or how did he deal with it?
Not always very well. because the medieval times really conditioned Luther to a very great extent. And everybody will always invoke the Peasants' Revolt, which was terrible. This was a bloodshed. And yet, in Luther's understanding, there was no possibility for democracy as we have it in the 21st century. That was out of his realm. He could not envision that. That is no excuse for whatever he wrote, but it helps us to understand where he's coming from. Terrible things that he also said about the Jews. And fortunately, Lutheran churches all over the world pretty much have acknowledged that as a major mistake. And I think that is why we consider ourselves Christians, first of all. And we speak the language of Lutheranism, but you know, we also are very critical to the early reformers, because I mean their worldview was very limited in that sense. Yeah. But thank you for pointing that out. I gather that you are a Lutheran pastor.
How can you tell?
Because you are a prophet when we need one.
Another thing that I've experienced in various contexts is this idea of, you know, we want to go in and help take care of this. This is what you need. This is, and we often have this, trust me, we know this is what's going to work right for you. And I don't know whether that's this, we want to get it done now, instant gratification kind of stuff. We're the smart ones. We know what's going on. This will take care of things for us. We often aren't as smart as we think we are in a lot of ways, you know. But I think there's some of that issue that we haven't resolved. And I also think there's some reluctance to accept it if it is reality, too, from the other direction, too.
Right. That's really
nice. On the flip side of that, having just returned from a youth mission trip to Ecuador, one of the organizations that we worked with takes Ecuadorian street boys and brings them into House Casa G. And the organization is no longer accepting North American volunteers, flat out, because what they realized is they're taking these street boys and they're bringing them into a house with a commitment of however long they need to be able to stay. But it was all North Americans that were there to aid and assist them, and they were not equipped then to go back to whatever Ecuadorian level of life they were entering back into. So it was neat for me to be able to see that on no level will they accept North American help anymore. And that also put pressure then on the Ecuadorians to step into the role of missionary within their own country. So that was neat to see.
I think the whole discussion about service learning has gone a step further in the last years. And experiences like that now challenging people who have come back into redefining what the purpose of that experience is. If it's just a feel-good experience, then it's not really transformational. But what does that entail? What does that require? How do we have activities that have continuity also on a local level? And as you said, these are new developments that are happening as we're talking.
And as much as that organization says, we won't take you as volunteers, but here are things that you can do back within your country. So the boys make artisan crafts. So if you want to become online to sell the artisan's crafts in North America, that's fine. And then the monies can go back to the organization. But you as a North American, in a sense, are not even welcome to participate in the daily lives of those children, which I applaud. I think is a good thing.
I think we would be negligent if we did not think of the issue of inclusivity. Most recently, of course, relative to sexual orientation, but also in terms of the larger issue of the intersection of oppression of all kinds, and the fact that we're seeing that issue not only within our own church and our own country, but globally. That's an amazingly challenging thing in terms of just expanding your whole concept of what it means to deal with justice and citizenship.
I'm as straight as it comes. and I felt the importance of advocating, again, for the LGBTQ community, coming from that very stance, and say, I'm not advocating, I'm not lobbying for myself and my village, I'm really advocating for a part of the church that has been invisible, and whose gifts we have missed, and we can really grow so much more also as a church by acknowledging that. And I think this is really the current challenge that we also have in terms of who are we advocating for, and how can we be more involved in always looking who is missing, who is left outside, who is not here. And that is the most difficult thing. It takes special eyes and, mm-hmm. and ears to just, you know, the void, the silence, and pay attention to the people who are not speaking, who are not visible. Can somebody read the two last paragraphs of this handout?
You can do it.
Yeah.
Please bear with my accent. Okay, the right of the citizen to be a citizen, not in terms of privileges, but in terms of participation in the earthly realm and living out Christian responsibility, is unable through the different spheres that bear God's promises. In the political sphere, politia, God promises to govern with justice and calls leaders to serve in that capacity. In the economic sphere, economia, God promises to care for the needs of all God's creatures and creates different instances from household to marketplace to assure well-being. In the ecclesial sphere, God promises to communicate God's word to our hearts and minds and calls believers to life in community to witness and learn about their faith. Christians are called to advocate on behalf of others and, in doing so, live out the love of the neighbor as instilled by Christ, while also promoting changes in society at large. As Luther points out, citizenship involves a component of responsibility for and accountability to the neighbor who requires a response. When Luther unfolds the consequences of neighborly love, he establishes that this love is more than a virtue one possesses as moral excellence or goodness, or an obligation as fulfillment of the law. It is a way of life, an ability to interact, engage, and genuinely care. It is a responsibility in the sense that we respond to God's call, voiced though the needs of our neighbor.
Through,
that's what I was thinking of. What am I thinking? Thank you.
So, what I have thought about sharing with you, do you have any questions, comments, reactions? We still have 4 minutes. I'm not bound by the law, so
I think the economic sphere presents great challenges to our Christian beliefs in really being able to contend with all the money that the world fights over, and really ignores this whole concept of pursuing neighborly love. So we talk about social justice, but this whole concept of neighborly love and having the moneyed interests in our world begin to recognize that need and deal with it is a huge obstacle, it seems.
Any thoughts about how to address that challenge? Do you have any thoughts? Because you brought it up.
Well, yeah, I do. It's part of that.
We can always resort to World Bank here, but
I think it starts basically with the individuals. I think it's that personal citizenship responsibility,
right,
is being able to speak up about it. We've seen some, I think, gains in the United States in terms of social justice at the corporate level, but I think that is a worldwide issue, and we don't do so well worldwide. Sometimes I think we need to, you know, the word needs to spread in that way, and it needs to be part of what we take on as our responsibility as Christians, and try to lead by that example.
Well said, yes.
Just to change the subject a little bit, I want to go back to that first paragraph about government being instituted by God. Mm-hmm. And the danger, of course, that we have is that we say everything the government does is okay because it's instituted by God. Mm-hmm. And part of our responsibility as citizens mm-hmm. is to make the government accountable.
And you know, the horrific consequence of that during the Second World War, mm-hmm. when the church in Germany fell back on that very idea, misunderstanding that the office of government is instituted by God, but not the officers themselves. And that in that mm-hmm. distinction, they failed mm-hmm. to make. And fortunately, there were people like Waterford and others who said truth to power and said, that's you are not understanding what this is all about. And the fact that Luther himself has very clear guidelines for what government is supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And the number one issue that government, he talks about government in the language of princes. And he says the princes are supposed to look out for the rights of those who are defenseless. The princes are supposed to make sure that the poor have food, that they have housing, that they have clothing. They are supposed to safeguard the rights of the poor and the widow. Very prophetic. And making sure that this is in place. And that's why we have government. If the princes would not do what God asked them to do, they would fall. And that's the language that he employs. Now, we no longer have princes in power, and yet that requirement, that mandate, continues to be the same. So it is what governments are supposed to accomplish, not necessarily the office itself. So that has changed, but the mandate is...
Huh? It seems so opposite to the direction the government of the United States is going right now.
Oh.
That's all.
I know. And I come from Brazil, a country that has been in debt for the majority of... I mean, I lived with an inflation of 50 to 60% a month. Okay, and now Brazil is supposed to be this growing economic power, and Brazil is stepping the same swing as the American economic boom, and that sometimes scares me. You know, the real estate market, and so some of the things that are going on that we just copy. Yeah.
I think frightening is that when the Supreme Court declared that corporations are people, or persons, and therefore can provide endless amount of money to any. What would Luther say?
But I would say is in that case that they are people for contributing to the lobbying that you mentioned, but they are not people for tax purposes, yeah. Which I will love to claim that. So, and I think that's the disjunction that we have in the rhetoric, in the Christian rhetoric regarding American politics, which is, yes, we claim the Christian values to justify our positions. But then that core value that either we see in the Gospels through Jesus' ministry, or in this case, Luther's understanding of the role of government in society, then that is neglected. Because now the big question is, what kind of compromises are we going to make to raise the ceiling on debt by cutting so-called entitlements? I mean, and that's the problem that we have in this country when it comes to understanding what is the role of government by those that claim to be Christians.
That's a that's why Luther said that if everybody was a real Christian, there would be no need for formal or government, but because sometimes we just claim to be, and it's not always that we are. In the meantime, I am personally interested in economies of solidarity, which is really a way of circumventing market, but assuring that there is quality of life and accessibility to food and water and housing, and how grassroots communities can organize themselves around that. There are some things that I do not understand, but I need to rely on others to better explain it to me, going after seeking that type of knowledge. I still cannot figure out how pension plans work in this country, it's, and retirement plans, and that's why I decided that I'm going to retire in Brazil, because it's simpler there. Because, I mean, sometimes systems, again, we are tricked into thinking that it is supposed to be so transparent, but it is ultimately so complicated that an average person is not supposed to understand what their rights, responsibilities, and how they can participate in this. So maybe we can create an international community to advocate for your rights in this country.
Sure.